So that's the first reason kids often aren't very good at using the higher and lower parts of their brain together. Their upstairs brain is still developing. The other main reason has to do with one particular part of the downstairs brain, the amygdala.
The baby gate of the mind. My amygdala made me do it. Our amygdala is about the size and shape of an almond and is part of the limbic area, which resides in the downstairs brain. The amygdala's job is to quickly process and express emotions, especially anger and fear. This little mass of gray matter is the watchdog of the brain, remaining always alert for times we might be threatened. When it does sense danger, it can completely take over or hijack the upstairs brain. That's what allows us to act before we think. It's the part of the brain that instructs your arm to stretch out to protect your passenger when you're driving and have to stop short. It's the part of the brain that encourages you to scream stop, as was the case when I was hiking with my young son, even before I was consciously aware that there was a rattlesnake a few feet up the trail. Of course, there are definitely times when it's good to act before thinking. In this situation, the last thing I needed was to have my upstairs brain go through a series of higher order maneuvers or perform some sort of cost-benefit analysis. Oh no, there's a snake up ahead of my son. Now would be a good time to warn him. I wish I had warned him a couple of seconds ago rather than going through the series of cogitations that led me to the decision to warn him. Instead, I needed my downstairs brain, in this case my amygdala, to take over, to do exactly what it did, cause me to call out even before I consciously realized what I was doing. Clearly, acting before thinking is a good thing when we're in a situation like mine, or when we're in danger in some other way. But acting or reacting before we think isn't usually so good in normal, everyday situations, like when we storm from our car and yell at another parent for breaking the no-waiting rule in the carpool pickup circle. As we'll explain in the Whole Brain Kids section to follow, that's what we call flipping our lid. It's how the amygdala can get us into trouble. It takes over and relieves the upstairs brain from its duties. When we're not truly in danger, we want to think before acting, instead of the other way around. We want our kids to do the same. The problem, though, is that, especially in children, the amygdala frequently fires up and blocks the stairway connecting the upstairs and downstairs brain. It's as if a baby gate has been latched at the bottom of the stairs, making the upstairs brain inaccessible. This, of course, further compounds the other problem we just discussed. Not only is the upstairs brain under construction, but even the part of it that can function becomes inaccessible during moments of high emotion or stress. When your three-year-old erupts in anger because there are no orange popsicles left in the freezer, his downstairs brain, including the brainstem and amygdala, has sprung into action and latched the baby gate. This primitive part of his brain has received an intense surge of energy, leaving him literally unable to act calmly and reasonably. Massive brain resources have rushed to his downstairs brain, leaving little to power his upstairs brain. As a result, no matter how many times you tell him that you have plenty of purple popsicles, which he liked better than orange last time anyway, he's probably not going to listen to reason in this moment. He's much more likely to throw something or yell at anyone nearby. As you know, if you found yourself in this situation, the best way to ease him through this crisis, and in his mind it really is a crisis, is to soothe him and help him shift his attention. You might pick him up and show him something else of interest in another room, or you might do something silly or off the wall to change the dynamics of the situation. When you do this, you are helping him unlatch the gate so that the stairway of integration can once again become accessible and he can engage his upstairs brain and begin to calm down. The same goes for when the problem isn't anger, but fear. Think of an active, athletic 7-year-old who refuses to learn to ride a bike. Her amygdala produces such paralyzing fear that she won't even attempt an activity at which she's more than capable of succeeding. Her amygdala has not only placed a baby gate at the bottom of the stairs, it has littered the stairway with the equivalent of balls, skates, books, and shoes, all kinds of obstacles that come from past frightening experiences and make it impossible to reach the higher parts of her brain. In this situation, there would again be many different possible strategies for clearing the pathway. Her parents might try to persuade her of the reward of taking on a new challenge. They might acknowledge and discuss their own fears. They might even offer an incentive to help her conquer her fear. Any number of approaches might work to help her clear the connection to her upstairs brain and quiet her amygdala, which is shouting the message that she might fall and hurt herself. Think about what this information means practically as we raise kids who don't have constant access to their upstairs brain. It's unrealistic to expect them always to be rational, regulate their emotions, make good decisions, think before acting, and be empathetic. All of the things a developed upstairs brain helps them do. They can demonstrate some of these qualities to varying degrees much of the time, depending on their age. But for the most part, kids just don't have the biological skill set to do so all the time. Sometimes they can use their upstairs brain and sometimes they can't. Just knowing this and adjusting our expectations can help us see that our kids are often doing the best they can with the brain they have. So does that give them a get-out-of-jail-free card? Sorry, Mom, that I squirted our new puppy's face with Windex. I guess my upstairs brain wasn't fully engaged. Hardly. In fact, it actually gives us parents even more incentive to see that our kids develop the faculties that result in appropriate behavior. And it gives us a pretty effective strategy for making some dicey decisions, especially when we're in the middle of a heated situation, like a tantrum. Tantrums, upstairs and downstairs. The dreaded tantrum can be one of the most unpleasant parts of parenting. Whether it takes place in private or in public, it can, in the blink of an eye, turn the person who owns our heart and moves mountains with one beautiful little smile into the most unattractive and repulsive being on the planet. Most parents have been taught that there's only one good way to respond to a tantrum: ignore it. Otherwise, you communicate to your child that she has a powerful weapon to wield against you, and she will wield it over and over again. But what does this new knowledge about the brain say about tantrums? When you know about the upstairs and downstairs brain, you can also see that there are really two different types of tantrums. An upstairs tantrum occurs when a child essentially decides to throw a fit. She makes a conscious choice to act out, to push buttons, and terrorize you until she gets what she wants. Despite her dramatic and seemingly heartfelt pleas, she could instantly stop the tantrum if she wanted to. For instance, if you gave in to her demands or reminded her that she is about to lose a cherished privilege. The reason she can stop is that she is using her upstairs brain at that moment. She is able to control her emotions and body, to be logical and make good decisions. She may look like she's completely out of control as she screams in the middle of the mall, "I want those princess slippers now!" But you can see that she knows what she's doing and that she's definitely working from strategy and manipulation to achieve a desired end. That you drop everything and immediately buy the slippers. A parent who recognizes an upstairs tantrum is left with one clear response: never negotiate with a terrorist. An upstairs tantrum calls for firm boundaries and a clear discussion about appropriate and inappropriate behavior. A good response in this situation would be to calmly explain, I understand that you're excited about the slippers, but I don't like the way you're acting. If you don't stop now, you won't get the slippers, and I'll need to cancel your playdate this afternoon because you're showing me that you're not able to handle yourself well. Then it's important to follow through on those consequences if the behavior doesn't stop. By providing this type of firm limit, you're giving your daughter practice at seeing the consequences of her inappropriate actions and at learning to control her impulses. You're teaching her that respectful communication, patience, and delayed gratification pay off, and that contrary behaviors don't. Important lessons for a developing brain. If you refuse to give in to upstairs tantrums, regardless of the age of your child, you'll stop seeing them on a regular basis. Since upstairs tantrums are intentional, children will stop returning to that particular strategy when they learn that it's ineffective, and often even leads to negative results. A downstairs tantrum is completely different. Here, a child becomes so upset that he's no longer able to use his upstairs brain. Your toddler becomes so angry that you poured water on his head to wash his hair that he begins screaming, throwing toys out of the tub, and wildly swinging his fists, trying to hit you. In this case, the lower parts of his brain, in particular his amygdala, take over and hijack his upstairs brain. He's not even close to being in a state of integration. In fact, the stress hormones flooding his little body mean that virtually no part of his higher brain is fully functioning. As a result, he's literally incapable, momentarily at least, of controlling his body or emotions, and of using all of those higher-order thinking skills like considering consequences, solving problems, or considering others' feelings. He's flipped his lid. The baby gate is blocking access to the upstairs, and he simply can't use his whole brain. When you later tell someone that your child totally lost his mind, you'll actually be more neurologically accurate than you realize. When your child is in this state of disintegration and a full-blown downstairs tantrum has erupted, a completely different parental response is called for. Whereas a child throwing an upstairs tantrum needs a parent to quickly set firm boundaries, an appropriate response to a downstairs tantrum is much more nurturing and comforting. As in the connect and redirect technique we discussed in Chapter 2, the first thing a parent needs to do is to connect with the child and help him calm himself down. This can often be accomplished through loving touch and a soothing tone of voice. Or, if he has gone so far that he's in danger of hurting himself or someone else or destroying property, you may have to hold him close and calmly talk him down as you remove him from the scene. You can experiment with different approaches depending on your child's temperament, but what's most important is that you help soothe him and steer him away from the chaos bank of the river. There's no sense in talking about consequences or appropriate behavior. He simply can't process any of that information when he's in the middle of his downstairs tantrum, because that conversation requires a functioning upstairs brain that can listen and assimilate information. So, your first task, when your child's upstairs brain has been hijacked by his downstairs brain, is to help calm his amygdala. Then,